So the piece that we have to focus on and actually action is what we can control, right? And so I say this to people all the time. There are only two things that we can control. Do you know what they are?
No.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body balance, and inner badass, these are the themes we are exploring. So a podcast that focuses on business, health, and mindset really would not be complete without the advice and perspective of my guest today. Dr. Shyamala Kiru is a family and couples therapist. She's been in practice for over a decade, and really the focus of her work is on how to develop high performance relationships. This is with your boss, with your girlfriends, with your kids, and certainly with your partner. On today's episode, we really delve into the ways of thinking that get us into trouble when we are in relationships, and you'll be surprised by some of them. I know as we were going through some of the most common thinking traps that we fall into, I was like, I know when I go into that one. And we not only talked about all the things that we are doing wrong, we talked about some of the key things that we can do to actually get us out of trouble when it comes to relationships. Bo Shyamala and I also discuss what it is that we see as features in our own private practices of those people who really have their act together. For me, I'm talking about it with individuals. For her, she goes through those characteristics of those high performance couples and some of the key features that they have that not only enable them to have incredible relationships, but a heightened degree of intimacy and trust. It was such an incredible conversation, so important to all of us. It's really my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Shyamala Kiru. Dr. Shyamala Kiru, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast.
Thank you so much, Megan. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm super stoked to have you as well. And finally, I was just saying this as we were getting started, we better darn well hit record and jump into this because I had the sense that we were just going to start to unpack so much gold even before the interview started that we just decided to jump right in. But you are an expert in relationships, high performance relationships. We're going to talk about this today in the context of our relationships with partners, with business partners, with kids, with our friends. And I think what you and I have really uncovered together is this, at least what you've made me realize, is there's sort of this epidemic of poor relationships. We skirt around issues and we're not really sure how to handle it. And you are just so good at providing language and framework for people to just jump in and ask for what they need in a way where everyone feels comfortable. So I want to unpack all of this with you today. But perhaps before we even do that, can you just give everyone a background in terms of your journey personally and professionally, why it is that you are so passionate about helping people unlock their high performance relationships?
Yes, absolutely. So I have been in practice for about 15 years now. And so my specialty, what I did my doctorate in, is actually couple and family therapy. So much of my training has been intensely on examining, exploring, and really optimizing relationships. And so I actually was practicing for probably about half of my career almost before I actually became a mom and before I became a parent. And so I have a 9-year-old daughter. So, 9 years ago, my world was rocked. So I sort of, up until that point, had sort of lived life feeling like I was a high performer, like I was doing really, really well. I was able to manage multiple stressors. I was, killing it at work. I was rocking it at school. I was doing all of the things that brought me passion and energy and excitement. And then all of that changed for me becoming a parent. It became so difficult for me to sort of navigate all the different challenges that were being thrown my way, all the different expectations that were being thrown my way. And I found myself headed toward burnout, which is so common for so many of the women that I work with. And it was at that point in my career that I began to really understand the connection between our mindset, the way that we communicate or ask for what we need, and healthy relationships. So it was at that point that I really began to sort of narrow down and kind of niche down my practice to really supporting women in not only finding their voice and identifying what their needs are, but being able to ask for what they need so that they can show up well, first and foremost for themselves, but then for everybody else.
Yeah, I love this. And I love that you've anchored this in your own personal journey. And I really want to unpack what it means to actually have a good relationship, because one of the things that I have observed is that I feel like in circles of women, we're going to talk about women in particular, we're good at being social. Like, we know how to socialize, but I don't actually always find we are good at having, I don't know the right word, I'm going to call it a mature relationship. So we can inherently socialize, we can get in these groups, and we are really good at galvanizing community. But I think there are probably features and characteristics of what I'm labeling, and you can relabel, a mature relationship that I think sometimes we're not aware of. We skirt around issues, we're scared to be direct, we have tactics to be able to navigate those relationships. Can we just start by like laying out what a, you pick the new word for it, mature relationship really looks like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, maturity is, it is a good word. It's a good descriptor, because one of the things I think happens for all of us is we grow up within our family of origin system, and we are given a set of templates for what relationships look like. And if we were to be really honest with ourselves, most of us did not grow up with the ideal or the healthiest or the most mature template for relationships. And then we take those templates and then we basically, continue that pattern over and over and over again in most of our primary relationships. So I think there is something to be said about maturing, about developing emotional intelligence skills in terms of just finding our own voice that should happen developmentally, but often doesn't happen. And this is where we get really stuck.
What are some of the key features of these? Can I call it a mature relationship? Are we on board with that?
Let's call it a mature. I like, you know, and sometimes I joke with my clients. I'm like we need to adult in our relationships.
Yeah,
we really do.
True.
We need to stop behaving like the 15, 16 and 17 year old that was throwing tender tantrums or that was shutting down or that was, you know, doing all sorts of, you know, other things to communicate her needs. We need to actually, you know, put on our big girl panties and step up to the plate. And we need to own our needs and be able to express them confidently.
Why don't we do that?
So I think it goes back, and there's different types of communication styles that are quite problematic. The reasons why, Megan, are always rooted in two things, our core beliefs, right? So those core problematic beliefs that we've developed. And the second thing, it's rooted in family of origin, right? So it goes back to those primary relationships. They are incredibly powerful and incredibly impactful in terms of how we learn to exist in the world and how we see ourselves in the world. So when we have dysfunctional or unhealthy templates from our family of origin, we carry those forward.
Okay. I totally hear you and get that. And I think sometimes too, we have these societal norms that we anchor ourselves to as well. And we have, we were talking about this earlier and I'd love to unpack this right now. And that is the different ways that we actually ask for things as women. So we can talk about this in the context of our like partnered relationships and work relationships. And I don't even know if it matters what relationship it is, but I have observed there is a discernible difference between how women step forward and ask for things that they feel that they deserve and men's willingness to step forward. And I will give you an example today. I received an email from someone asking if they could speak at one of our events. And this was a really awesome gentleman who's done some really cool things. And he was just like, I'd love to speak. I'm sure you have all your speakers selected already. I would add amazing value to your audience. And here's my background. Here's what I'm all about. Thanks so much. And I was speaking to another woman this morning who I said, I would really love for you to participate in our event next year. And she'd be great. She's like, oh my gosh, I would never have even thought to ask. I thought I was like years away from that. And neither one of them, like he wasn't rude or belligerent. He was very much, when we talked the other day about the idea between aggressive and assertive, he was asking for something and didn't, he was like, if it doesn't work, that's fine. Wasn't attached to the outcome. And whereas I feel like it would have taken years for her, if ever, to step forward and pose that question. What are we so scared of as women? And is there a new way of thinking around this idea of being assertive about what we want that can be potentially empowering to moving in that direction? Because I think we hold ourselves back because we're scared of what people are going to think if we ask for what we really want.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And so I think what you're describing with the woman that you were communicating with is more of a passive style, right? It's that passive style. The fear there is often a profound fear of rejection. So I am so afraid that if I put myself out there, I am going to be rejected, that I am actually not good enough and people are going to find this out, right? And so the passive style will avoid conflict. And even though it may not feel conflictual or confrontational to simply ask, hey, listen, I'd love to speak at your event. When you have developed this intense fear of rejection and you've developed a style that avoids conflict at all costs, something as simple as asking for, and it's not even asking for a need, it's saying, hey, I'd love to partner with you in this, right? In this project. That can feel very, very scary.
And then in contrast, like, how do we get past that? Because there's just no way all women feel that way. And yet there's times where I feel like, hey, ladies, I think we all feel this way.
Right, right. So it goes back to the core beliefs. The core beliefs around that kind of style, it's you know, this idea that others are actually more important than I am. And sometimes that's men might be perceived as more important, more competent, more confident, more capable, right? So there might be that perception. There could also be the idea that somehow others are entitled to have control over their lives and I am not. My role is to be sort of serve or to be subservient, to be more passive. And so it's really challenging those core beliefs and developing a new set of beliefs around, the way you said it, is assertiveness, that there is nothing wrong with being assertive. There is nothing wrong with knowing, identifying, and asking for what your needs are. And I think where we get caught is when we mistake assertiveness for aggressiveness, right? Or any form of aggressiveness. And for me, the biggest distinction is that assertiveness, it's not about getting your own way, right? So it's not about asking so that I can get my way. It's not about asking to speak at your event so that I am definitely going to be speaking at your event. Instead, it's recognizing that I'm in charge of my behaviors and I'm the driver of my choices, right? So it's my responsibility to ask you for what I need. And I need to know and understand that you are responsible for your own behaviors and your own choices. And so you have every right to say yes, no, maybe, let me think about it, whatever it is.
Yeah, I really like that. Not being attached to the outcome and not making assumptions around the response.
That's right. That's right. And not making, and I think the biggest problematic assumption that we make is, oh my goodness, no, this, like, you know, this would never be valuable to this person. I would never be good enough for that. I'm sure there are way more people that are more competent than I am. So I'm not even going to bother asking.
Right. I think we all fall into that trap. I have fallen into that trap. I have to catch myself when I am engaging in that inner self-talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of these things, and you talk about it often, right? As we, I think, move up in different areas of our life and different levels of complexity, we may become comfortable in one particular arena and feel a certain level of competence or confidence in one particular arena. But then what if we want to reach higher? Or what if we want to, you know, step up on that, the next rung on that ladder? That, again, that anxiety and that fear and that fear of rejection can come flooding back for so many of us.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I've been talking about this a lot lately, about this idea that we use our comfort zone and the anxiety around being outside of our comfort zone as actually a barometer that we're moving in the right direction. So rather than working so hard to eliminate that feeling in our life, it's almost like we close our eyes and we look for it and move towards it. And I have actually found, and I've been speaking a lot about this idea, that when I hang out in that space where I'm always actually moving towards that place where I'm uncomfortable, that's where the most exponential growth has taken place. But I've been able to do that because I've been really starting to shift my core beliefs around the consequences of hanging out in that anxiety zone.
That's right. That's right. And it's sort of embracing it, right? And there's such a fine line, I think, between there is anxiety. Often there's nervousness. There's this anticipatory kind of anxiety that comes with doing something new and big and awesome. But then there's excitement there as well, right? And if we can tap into the excitement that comes with that and the possibility and the opportunity and the all of those really positive pieces of doing, like stepping out of our comfort zone, then I think it's so much easier to manage that anxiety. And just what you said is knowing that anxiety is part of it. That nervousness does not mean that you don't deserve to step up to that next level or move into a new and different arena or try things that perhaps you haven't done before, right? Anxiety is not a good indicator that you're not doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And the abolishment of anxiety in my mind is not the goal.
That's right. Because it is so part and parcel of the journey. You know, and I talk about this so much with relationships, right? And I know many of your listeners are parents, right? That parenting journey and that parenting relationship, there is anxiety that is inherent in that relationship. I've yet to meet a parent that doesn't experience some level of anxiety when it comes to raising their children.
Yes, like every single day.
Yeah. right. Every, like moment to moment state, like, you know, developmental stage to developmental stage, like that anxiety is so present. So it is, I actually think it's a limiting belief to say, you know what, I'm going to get rid of my anxiety. And so when I work with people on anxiety and I say, well, what's the goal here? And they're like, get rid of it. Zero. I want no anxiety. I'm like, that is not possible. Like that's not even healthy, right? We need to feel some of that nervousness, some of that angst, right? And it can really, as long as we anchor it in that sort of excitement that can come with the newness and the pushing out of the comfort zone, we can manage it.
100%. So let's take this concept of anxiety, and we have a million and one possible triggers of it. And let's talk about some of the key mindset pieces that are often triggers for our anxiety, but are also often triggers for us not necessarily having these high performance relationships. And I think for both, we can step into, and I think this is your label, thinking traps, in terms of how we approach our relationships or how we approach situations that then triggers an avoidance pattern. In this case, I want to talk about what are the thinking traps, the misnomers, the assumptions that we make about any given situation that get in the way of us having high performance relationships.
Lots. And so it's so interesting to me, right? So we sort of work primarily with about like 16 different thinking traps. There's overlaps with all of them. And thinking traps, for those of you who don't know it, they're cognitive distortions. So they're patterns or ways of thinking that we have developed over time and through experience that actually distort the way that we see ourselves, the way that we see our relationships, and the way that we see the world around us, right? And so there are several that really impact. And this was for me, honestly, Megan, like the fascinating part about my journey as a clinician is realizing and recognizing that without addressing the mindset piece and without then addressing the communication piece, it's virtually impossible to have healthy, fulfilling, and authentic relationships. Right? So this whole idea of I can just work on my relationship without working on myself, I think is bullshit, in all honesty. I think you absolutely need that foundation of really having that healthy relationship with yourself. And that totally starts in your mind in order to then appropriately navigate your relationships.
Where do we start with that? And here's the context for it. I have a lot of patients they're constantly working on themselves. And I know exactly what that means, and so do you. And then I have other patients who come in and we talk about this idea of doing self-work. They're like, what does that actually even mean? Like, what does it mean to do work on yourself? Where do I start? How do I even understand what work? I don't know what I don't know in that respect. And as someone is really starting to understand themselves and where they may have patterns of thinking that are not necessarily helping them, how do we help them to recognize those? And then what do they do next?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the place to start is a great question, and it can be incredibly overwhelming and difficult to sift through all the self-help material that is out there.
I've noticed there's a little bit of that.
It's great. Like it's mind-boggling to me, honestly, just how many different approaches and ideas and just resources, and they collect dust on people's bookshelves. But really, it's pretty simple, right? So often when people present with any type of distress, whatever that is, it's often they might describe it in terms of feelings, like what they're actually feeling. I feel afraid, I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel sad, I feel overwhelmed, all of those sorts of things. Or they might describe it in terms of their behaviors, right? So some of the choices, some of the actions, some of the things that are happening in their life. But really where it all starts is with our thoughts. Right? So it all starts with our thinking. And what we don't do, the thing that we don't do, is slow down enough to actually identify what's going on in our heads. Right? So we move at such a quick pace. We're constantly reacting to what's in front of us. We're feeling things, we're doing things. It's not working. It feels incredibly distressful. We feel so overwhelmed. And what we don't do well is slow down and have sort of a structured way of really identifying what the thoughts are in our head. And so when we work with people, what we do is, number one, we do a little bit of psychoed, right? So we do some teaching around what are the common thinking traps, like what are the most common things that we would fall into that can get us really stuck in a cycle of toxic thinking. And then we need to get really specific in terms of what are my specific thoughts? Like what are the things that happen in my head day in and day out that get me stuck, right? And so is an example helpful?
Yes.
Okay. So let's do an example. Yes. Let's do an example. So for example, a feeling that I hear many women tell me is that they feel overwhelmed, right? I feel overwhelmed. And we can get really stuck in, oh my God, I feel so overwhelmed. I can't get out of this feeling of overwhelm. And it's like just all around me. And so what we do is we slow it down and we say, okay, let's figure out the thought that is driving that feeling. And the way we do that is a very simple formula is I feel overwhelmed because I think. And so often we think we feel overwhelmed because of all the events of our life. All the things that are on our plate are making me feel overwhelmed. And that's actually not true. What is causing that feeling of overwhelm is what you are saying to yourself about all of the events in your life that are leaving you feel overwhelmed. So a thought that might drive that feeling might be something like, I feel overwhelmed because I think I have to do it all. So that is probably, right? Like that's probably one, or I have to do it perfectly, or I have to make sure, you know, like my kids don't fail. I have to, right? It's I have to. Right? There's all this stuff. And when you actually slow it down and really examine that thought, it becomes clear very quickly that it's really not true, that it is a lie and a very toxic, negative way of thinking that you have been filtering through your cognitive perspective day in and day out. And the amazing thing is that we usually, the toxic thoughts that we have, Megan, we've had for years. They're not new, right? Like it's not something that just pops in our head one day. It's often a pattern of thinking that we've developed. And sometimes it's a pattern of thinking that we've actually grown up with.
Yeah, I've seen that. And you know what? I last month I decided I was doing a money mindset audit for myself. And so every day I would challenge myself with respect to different pieces. And then I would very tangibly write down the core belief or the thought that came up or whenever I felt uncomfortable about whatever task I was doing that day. And then the next thing I would do in the next column, I literally had to write down, is this true? And it was so fascinating because I went through it and I was like, oh, I did it for a month. Here are 30 core beliefs that I had around money and abundance. And beside like 95% of them, they weren't even true. Like they weren't based in reality. They were just that core thing that I had kind of always told myself. And so there's something really powerful about connecting to those thoughts and just asking whether or not it's true. I love that.
And it's so, and it's, and once you like identify just how simple it is, I think it's incredible. I love that you wrote it down. I think that is really, really important when you're starting on that quote unquote journey of working on yourself. It's a journey that, in my opinion, almost sort of like never ends, right? We're constantly doing that. But when you're starting on that journey, there's something incredibly powerful about just writing those thoughts down, because I'm sure you must have had this experience. As you're writing them down, you're probably like, oh my gosh, like, am I actually saying this to myself? And almost immediately you can begin seeing that it's 95, and I will validate that stat, 95% of those thoughts, actually, it's probably more like 98%, are actually not true, right? And they're repetitive. That's what for me is causes the greatest amount of stuckness, that of the, like, it's like 70,000 thoughts that we have per day, 98% of them are simply repeated from the day before. Like, we're just repeating, we're recycling the same toxic thoughts, the same limiting beliefs over and over and over again, because we're not slowing down.
Yes, I totally agree. And then I know there's someone driving right now and they're like, that's fantastic for all the people who have time to slow down, but what am I supposed to do?
Well, and here's the thing, right? Is that I think you have to. I think you absolutely, you at some point, and whether it's you take 30 minutes, 15 minutes at the end of the day, when you're really working on this, to actually write those thoughts down, it eventually becomes so habitual to identify those negative thoughts that you can do it while you're driving, right? You don't have to always do it in that really concrete way. You don't have to pull out the journal and the pen every single time, but it certainly does help initially to even visually and psychologically see it in black and white, to see it all written out and to really be able to go through those and go, nope, that's not true. No, that's not true. Oh my gosh, over there, I'm just focusing on stuff I can't control, right? So there are these principles and these guidelines that you can sort of go through as you challenge your negative thoughts that will really help you to overturn those toxic beliefs, right? But you sort of have to do it in a concrete way before it becomes, and what we hope for is that it becomes automatic to begin challenging those thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And it can, at least in my experience, it can become automatic.
Yes, that's right. And so that doesn't mean that those thoughts won't pop into your head, because they do. We're human, right? Those thoughts will still pop into your head, but you will recognize them so much quicker and you can jump on it. You can jump on those thoughts and go, wait a minute, that is not true. I'm not going to allow myself to sit with that.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And I think that's super powerful. Can you take us through some of the other thinking traps and, well, that we fall into?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So some of the most common ones that I would say women in particular fall into is catastrophizing, right? That one, I think most of us are somewhat familiar with that idea. So it's that whole idea of making a mountain out of a molehill. So taking a very small, like a small event, a small, like even just a small challenge that happened, something that just kind of didn't go the way that we had wanted it to go. And then like just making it this incredibly huge crisis, like catastrophizing that. And then now spending the next like few hours, days, or even weeks sometimes worrying about that small event. Right. So that's a really, really common one. The other one that's fairly common, and this has a pretty significant impact actually on relationships, is that all or nothing thinking. So being really, really rigid in the way that you see things. Things are very black and white. So not only does that get us stuck in terms of our own mindset, but that what ends up happening is then when we are relating to others, we're relating to them with that very rigid and fixed mindset. So it makes it really difficult to resolve conflict, for example.
Yeah, I can see that, because there's no common ground. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And there's no opportunity for multiple perspectives. There's no opportunity for, okay, so this is my opinion and I can see that you see it very, very differently and that's all okay, right? So that there are certain mindset traps that really do have a pretty significant impact relationally. The other one is making demands, right? So having some really fixed and rigid ideas around how life should go, how my relationship should go, how my day should go, right? And not like there's no room for any alternative perspectives. There's no room for another person to offer influence. So that again can have a pretty significant impact on relationships as well.
And a huge impediment on leadership.
Oh, absolutely, right? And so when I say relationships, I'm talking about relationship, whether it's with your partner or your children or coworkers or colleagues or, you know, parents. Like, I mean, it's all across.
Okay, tell me about fortune telling. And is it really, like, is it in the same family as catastrophizing?
It's a little bit different. Again, so here's the thing. Most of these thinking traps, Megan, are fear-based, right? So anxiety is a fear-based emotion. It's based out of fear. So a lot of these are driven by fear. So that's where you'll see some of the similarities. The difference with fortune telling is it's this really intense and almost exclusive focus on the future. So it makes it impossible for you to be in the present at all because you're constantly looking to the future and you're looking into the future and it looks threatening. It looks like it is full of crisis and only bad things will happen and things will only go wrong, right? And it's sort of going into the future and just predicting really, really negative outcomes. And so it keeps you, it like literally in the future, and it keeps you in a narrative that may never happen and often doesn't happen.
What if we use that in a good way?
And tell me what you're thinking.
Okay, so here's what I did a few weeks ago. I was speaking at an event in California and I was really super nervous about it, like really nervous about it. And I could catch myself in that state of anxiety going through the motions of like completely catastrophizing it. What if I step out? We had no notes. Like we were like buzzed off stage. We went over, like they set you up to feel anxious. And I was like, what if I forget it? What if like some of the biggest thinkers in my industry are here and I walk out stage and I look silly? What if people have expectations? I don't live up. Like I went there and then I was like, wait a second. What if I nail it? And what if I do like such a good job that someone is like, I want you on my podcast or my show, or like, what if it leads to new opportunities? And I found as soon as I just like actually went in and started to daydream and imagine about everything else that could happen, I could feel my dopamine rise. And I realized that dopamine trumps adrenaline. And so I was actually, I don't know what the opposite was, but I was like, I put an equal amount of effort into whatever I was doing that is the opposite of catastrophizing.
Right. I love it.
And it was actually really fun. And I was like, oh, you had to pull yourself there. It was kind of like running uphill versus rolling downhill. It's way easier to be negative than positive. But when you get close to the top, and when the more I kept doing it, the more excited I was to step on stage. I wasn't dreading it. It was almost like I couldn't access those negative feelings.
Right. And so for me, as I hear you talking about that, I literally, it's almost like I visualize you moving from that. Remember, we talked about that nervous, anxious energy and actually channeling the excitement that was, it was there. The excitement was there. You just needed to tap into it. And so you used what ifs in a positive way. Like, what if it was awesome? What if it's this and that and all these amazing things? And for me, that really sort of makes me think about like kind of sports or performance psychology. Right? Where really high level elite athletes will visualize themselves like knocking it out of the park, right? Like playing at their, like, I'm not an athlete at all. Like at their, you know what I mean? At their like the best possible
level.
Don't
catastrophize. I want you to picture yourself as a good athlete.
Love to exercise, but yeah. Team sports, not my thing. Right. But it's that sort of idea. It's almost like, so yeah, going into the future, projecting really positive outcomes.
100%. It was really cool. I just say to everyone, just try that. I say the same to my patients when they're like, and then this could happen. I'm like, well, what if it didn't? Like, can we just spend as much time painting that positive picture? And I by no means have the training that you have, but I was like, every time dopamine will trump adrenaline if you go there and you really try to push it.
Right. And that's the thing. And if you go there, right? And what keeps us from going there is fear, right? And fear will tell us, no, listen, you better listen to me because I'm going to keep you safe. I'm going to protect you.
Right.
I'm not going to let you fail. I'm not going to let you look like a fool. Right. And then we believe those lies. And then we're like, okay, right. So I better be really, really careful here and not, I shouldn't imagine positive like outcomes or all these possibilities or all these opportunities. Cause what if that doesn't happen?
Thank you, primitive brain. Okay. What are some of the other ones that we do?
So what are some of the other ones? Mind reading. I think, in all honesty, women, we struggle with this probably more than men do. And mind reading is probably, you can guess it. It's, you know, telling yourself that I know exactly what you are thinking about me, and it must be this, and it must be negative. And you know, there's no way that you see me as competent, or that you value me or respect me. And it's literally telling yourself that you can read other people's minds. And it happens. And interestingly enough, I think it happens often in professional relationships, but it also happens quite often in couple relationships. And part of that is, you know, you just get really used to your partner and their mannerisms and their behaviors and all of those sorts of things. And you can begin to really put assumptions and label their behaviors as meaning something that they don't.
What are some of the things that we do in those couple relationships on a really common, you've been a clinician for a really long time, so you see patterns in relationships. What are some of the most common things that we do with our partners that really keep us from having those high performance relationships?
Yeah. Oh, love this question. So I think that a lot of it comes back to, we're going to circle back to where we started, which is sort of communication style, right? And, you know, unfortunately, in many couple relationships, people fall into either that passive style, the aggressive style, and usually someone with a passive style will attract somebody with a more aggressive style, or the passive aggressive style becomes a really, really common one. They're so unhealthy. They are so toxic. They literally suck the intimacy and the authenticity and the joy out of relationships. And then people literally become shells of themselves. And sometimes it creates intense conflict. But the other thing, honestly, Megan, that's equally as dangerous to relationships is distance, right? Is that incredible distance, that vast and that vacuum that can sort of develop between two people, because there is no space to be open. There is no space to be honest. It's not okay for me to express what I think, feel, and need, because I'm afraid that you will leave me, or you'll reject me, or you'll abandon me, or you'll get mad at me, and I can't tolerate that, right? And so then we create these really, really unhealthy patterns of relating to one another that are just so far from anything that actually defines intimacy.
I realized, even in asking that question, I focused on what are the things that people do that are bad. So I am going to, before we even unpack that more, I'm going to ask you, what are the features of high performance relationships that you see over and over again? What are the things that they are actually doing that help make them high performance relationships?
Right. Love it. Okay. So one of the things that couples are constantly negotiating, right? So one of the things we're constantly negotiating is togetherness versus separateness, right? So how much of our relationship is the togetherness, the we're aligned, we've got similar values, we've got maybe similar interests, all those sorts of things. And how much is separate, right? So what parts of our relationship am I an individual, and I have these things that maybe you've got no interest in, right? And so negotiating and navigating togetherness and separateness well is really, really important, right? And the way that we do that is we make lots and lots and lots of space for differences, for disagreements, for disappointment, right? You've got to make space. It should be okay to feel disappointment in your intimate relationship, right? It should be okay for your partner to disappoint you and not meet all of your needs, and vice versa, right? But there has to be safety and space in order to express and explore all of that. Is that making sense?
Totally. And I don't mean to say I'm assuming, but I am guessing that in those relationships where that give and take works well, that you're not falling into these thinking traps. You're not making assumptions about the other person having their own life and what that could possibly mean. You've done the self-work to move out of those thinking traps that enables that to happen.
Yes, right? Yes, absolutely. Because unless you have done the work to sort of develop your own sense of self and identity and self-worth and confidence, it's virtually impossible to show up well in your most intimate relationships, right? If anyone's going to see the good, bad, and ugly, it is your partner and your children, right? They are going to see all of it. And I just don't think you can fake it. Like, I really don't think you can fake doing the work. And so if there isn't that authentic sense of, it's not like I'm perfect and I have it all together, but it is that, you know, like, this is who I am and I'm okay showing you the parts of me that I'm really proud of and the parts of me that I'm still like working on and growing in. But I go back to this and I really want you and I want the listeners to get it. Like without this, the safety, Megan, to show up in those ways, there's no way to experience intimacy. And so it goes back to the conversation we initially had around assertiveness, right? Like, so in order for, even if I were to use our friendship, right? In order for our friendship to be a breeding ground for authenticity and growth and, you know, intimacy, you know, emotional, all of those sorts of things, I have to have the safety and the freedom to express myself to you without a repercussion. And you have to have the freedom to, you know, be in a space where I'm expressing myself to you and not feel like you owe me anything, right? Like, you don't have to say yes, you don't have to say no, you don't have to, right? So I should be able to say, you know, I really need to spend more time with you. I really need more of your time. And the person that I'm saying that to has to have the freedom to say, I would love to do that, but no, I can't right now. Here's what I can do. And so that has, like, those conversations, when I say there's got to be the safety and the freedom to do that, we have to be able to do that while maintaining a certain degree of emotional regulation, right? So if I get emotionally activated every time you say no to me, you're going to feel that, right? And then you're not going to want to have those conversations with me. And then you're going to withdraw.
100%.
Right. So that's the piece, like, that's where it connects for me. And that's the piece that I think is so critical. And the relationships that I that thrive, right, and the intimacy continues to deepen are the relationships where there's a lot of freedom for that individuality. There's a lot of freedom for that separateness. And in fact, when individuals within a couple system have the freedom to exercise and express that independence, they're actually more securely attached to one another.
I can totally make sense.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful thing, actually, when you see it. It's a really beautiful thing.
And like I said before, what I see as you articulate that is all the work that both individuals have to do to be in a place where they're sufficiently secure that happens.
That's right. That's right.
Hence the self-worth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because it takes, you know, it takes a certain level of just kind of feeling comfortable in your own skin to be able to say to your partner, yeah, you know, go out there, do your thing. Like, right? Like, do your purpose and your passion and your whatever it is that you're doing out there in the world. And that does not cause me this feeling of insecurity or abandonment or rejection because you're doing X, Y, and Z.
And in the couples that you work with, I have had an observation in my own practice that those individuals who just kind of have their act together, they have always done the work. Like, I have yet to have someone who walks in where I'm like, whoa, like they're on top of it. They know themselves. They have good boundaries. Who hasn't been like, yeah, I've been in therapy for like 25 years. I would hope I have those things by now. Do you see the same thing with those like high performance couple relationships that they've really done work as a couple?
Yeah. And I think, and you nailed it. It's work as a couple for sure. It's work as a couple, but it's also work as individuals, right? Like, and I don't think you're going to have one without the other. You really can't. Like, the system, the couple system functions at its best when each individual has done their own work. And there is that separateness between the individual parts of that couple system. Right. But I joke all the time. I have a therapist. I still connect with my therapist when I need to. I see it as ongoing, right? I see it as like ongoing coaching and development and, you know, constantly, and especially as we move through different developmental stages, I think, as women, and our priorities shift and our schedules and our expectations, all of those things, it's remarkable how unsettling that can be for us. right? Like, I don't know if you've experienced that, but I mean, I certainly have, like different markers in my life developmentally, like before I kind of got my footing again, it's quite unsettling.
I think we all talk about this. We're like, I want to get back into the groove. And even as back to school is starting, everyone's like, okay, I'm ready to get back in the groove. Cause I feel like we equally need certainty and uncertainty almost at the same time. And the two kind of flourish in coexistence, but we can't have complete uncertainty and discombobulation all the time.
Agreed. And I think uncertainty is just all around us, right? Like our world can be a very uncertain place. I think where we have to look for certainty is within our ability to sort of manage our thoughts, to manage our mindset, to show up with our best selves, to communicate clearly and directly and overtly and assertively, right? Like, I think those are the things that we can feel a sense of certainty around, you know? And you know, anxiety really is the focus on things that we can't control.
Yes.
Right? Anxiety is the focus on the things that we can't control. And the things we can't control are external to us, right? It's like, it's other people's thoughts, it's other people's feelings, other people's choices. And most often that's what we feel most anxious about. It's what's happening outside of us.
We do. We have listeners who are sitting there like, I'm anxious all the time. What do I do next? And we have people who go, I know I'm in relationships, either my intimate relationships or my work relationships that could absolutely be better. Where do these individuals start? Like, what is step one? What is like the first takeaway that they can go and do to start to move forward away from that pattern of thinking?
Away from the pattern of focusing on the stuff they can't control, like the anxiety-based thinking. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Great question. So the piece that we have to focus on and actually action is what we can control, right? And so I say this to people all the time. There are only two things that we can control. Do you know what they are?
No, I can guess, but no. Breathing.
Okay. Two. Well, that's one of them. So it's actions, right? Breathing is an action. We can control our actions and we can control our thoughts.
Yeah.
Right. And that's like it's small. Like that's it. It's just those two things.
Yeah.
You know, when I say that to people, sometimes like, oh my God, that's all I can control. I'm like, yeah, but that's all you can control. Like there's also a freedom to that, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like that's where you need to focus your energy and attention and time on. You need to focus and action the things that you can control. So it's your thoughts and your actions. And so a really practical exercise that I go through with people, regardless of what the situation is, okay, we're going to make two lists. We're going to make a list of all of the things that you can't control, because that's probably all the stuff that's causing you anxiety. And then we're going to make a much smaller list of the things that you can control, right? And that's what we're going to action. We're going to actually focus there and we're going to move some of these pieces forward so that you can feel a sense of agency over your own life.
I love that. Sometimes it is actually that simple.
It is. It actually is. But, and I say this, it's super simple. It's just, it's not easy because it's not something we do regularly. But once you put that simplicity into practice, it becomes easier.
Jamila, I love this.
Do
so,
you?
So fun. I could do this all day long. It is, right? Because this is what actually consumes space in our life. This is what makes us not act the way we want to with our kids. This is what makes us rushed when we don't want to be rushed. It's managing all of these beliefs that we carry around all day long and these patterns of thinking. And really it's as simple as you can change your thoughts or you can engage in new actions, but that's it.
It's a short list and it's easy to remember. So once you have that principle, it's easy to remember it. You just got to remember to use it.
No, I love it. Guys, this is 20 years of therapy that just happened in the last 40 minutes. What a perfect place to transition in the interview. The second half of the interview, what we do is we focus on something called our KPIs or key performance indicators. So just like we have them in our businesses, I believe that we have them in our lives as well. So I've got a few rapid fire questions for you, if you will indulge me.
Awesome. Let's go.
All right. Who is inspiring you right now?
My daughter, there's something for me about showing up well for her. And I think she's 9 now. And as she gets older and she's becoming more and more articulate and she's identifying and expressing her needs and she's calling me on all my stuff that I still haven't worked through. Like it is one of those things, like she's such a mirror to me. And it inspires me to keep doing the work and showing up well for me and for her.
It is amazing how kids will trigger all the work we haven't done yet.
Trigger is a good word, Megan.
Fiction or nonfiction, what's your preferred genre and what are you reading right now?
My preferred genre is fiction. I love fiction, but to be really honest with you, I have not indulged in fiction in quite some time. I'm reading nonfiction and I'm currently reading Kelly Brogan's. We talked about Kelly Brogan the other day, A Mind of Your Own.
Oh, Kelly's so great. Mm-hmm. Good one. What is the one thing you're most consistent with respect to your health?
Can I say two things?
Okay.
Exercise, for sure. It just makes me a better human being. I think my family appreciates it when I start the day with exercise. And water.
Yeah.
Those are my two ride or die. Yeah.
What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
Oh my gosh. I don't even know how to answer. What is totally badass about me? I don't know that I'm all that badass.
You are. So you have to answer it. Yep.
Okay. I got to answer it. Okay. I'm going to say something that probably people would not know or not guess is when I was in high school, I actually played high school rugby. I played women's rugby for my high school team. And the reason most people would not guess that is if you've ever met me, I am 4'9".
You were not in the scrum, I am going to guess.
No, I sure was not. I was an inside center. So I did the running. But yeah, so that is probably something that most people would not guess about me.
Yeah, that's totally badass. I'm going to give that to you. What do you do for fun or play?
Probably the thing that I enjoy doing the most for fun or play is being outside in the backyard with my daughter, and water has got to be involved. So whether it's like water guns or sprinklers or water.
I get you. I hear you on that, sister. Last question, not to be black or white about it, but entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I think we grow into entrepreneurism. I think if we're doing something that is truly aligned with our purpose and our passion, I think then we're probably doing it pretty well and we get super stoked and excited about it. And we want to continue to grow and develop and innovate in whatever area that is. And then we somehow end up as entrepreneurs.
I will take that. You made that a little gray, and that is totally fine with me. Shamla Kiro, it has been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I know people are going to want to learn more about what you're up to. Where can we send them to hear more of your brilliance?
So I'm pretty active on Instagram. My handle is dr.shamlakiru. And there should be a link, which I created for this podcast, to do a mindset audit. So if you're interested in some of these thinking traps and kind of where you rank in terms of high performance habits, if you either go to to my Instagram, or if you go to our website, which is kiruwellness.com/mindset audit, you can take the free quiz.
Amazing. And we will hook all of that up in our show notes. And like always, those are found at meganwalker.com/podcast. And I believe this is episode 132. Shamla, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Megan.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.